Welcome to WITCAST, the podcast of the Women Inside Trade Network, an international organization that contributes to the empowerment of women and seeks to address a gender gap that still exists in Brazil and in the world when it comes to international trade.
So today we have another episode of our podcast, and we are going to discuss a report recently published by the Institute for International Trade of the University of Adelaide about agricultural subsidies and environmental impact. And we invited the authors of this report, Mr. Ken Ash and Mr. Anthony Cox, to discuss a little bit of the outcomes they found. So it's a pleasure to have both of you here today. Welcome.
Thank you. The pleasure is ours.
Thank you very much. Great to be on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Anthony and Ken. And according to the report, domestic support for agriculture is highly concentrated in just a handful of countries, and is further concentrated on relatively few commodities. Moreover, much of this support relies on policies, instruments that distort production and trade, and are environmentally harmful. What are the linkages between domestic support and environment impact, and why is domestic support environmentally harmful?
Well, I'll take that question first, Carolina. Actually, the linkages between domestic support and the environment are quite straightforward. They're relatively intuitive. And it revolves around the fact that as you provide support, whether it's subsidies such as fertilizer subsidies, pesticide subsidies, and so on, or market price support such as tariffs and quotas, This changes the economic incentives and the price cost structure that faces farmers. And as these relative prices change, so do the ways in which farmers produce their goods, what they produce, where they produce, and the kind of technologies that they use. And then these changes then flow into the impacts on the environment. We all know that farming has an intimate linkage with the environment, but if you take into account the costs that various inputs are charged to the farmers, this will change their incentives for things like if you provide subsidies, support for pesticides, for fertilizers and herbicides. This can lead to increased use of these products. And this can lead to an increased toxic chemical, nutrient and greenhouse gas emissions per unit of output. If you provide support for livestock, you can increase the livestock numbers that farmers are willing to put onto their land. And this can increase the environmental degradation associated with livestock, for example, through increasing greenhouse gas emissions, soil erosion, the spread of invasive species in grazing lands, and so on. And similarly with water subsidies. Around the world, we see a lot of irrigation gets subsidies, and this can lead to various environmental impacts, including increasing salinity, leading to surface and groundwater depletion and biodiversity loss due to loss of freshwater habitats. So these are just an example of the kinds of environmental impacts that exist between domestic support and that is provided to farming. But at the same time, we've also seen some agricultural policies that have positive impacts on the environment. For example, support for things such as carbon storage, resilience to natural disasters, support for pollination and habitat provision. But what our survey showed was that most of these types of positive environmental services are achieved by a range of agricultural policies other than subsidies, other than domestic support. For example, things like regulations and standards, technologies and performance standards, and environmental cross-compliance, and so on. So that's just a brief summary of what these linkages are.
Thank you so much, Anthony. I think I'm going to direct this question to Ken now, because basically one of the concluding elements of the report is how we should improve awareness and filling the knowledge gaps. At the same time, the report also mentions that the agricultural sector is the sector which has the higher amount of information already available. So what's the proposal then? How do you think we should improve awareness with so much information already available?
Yeah, thanks. So there is relatively more information available on agriculture than, for example, on industrial subsidies. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that we know everything we would like to know, and it doesn't mean that everyone is aware of the information that is available. So, quite frankly, this report is a very modest first step, attempting to bring together both available data and available analysis and make them more accessible. Just one very simple example, the WTO has a great deal of data available on domestic support, but its most recent reports only go to the period 2016. So that's 6 years ago. So a lot of users of that data discount its relevance because lots of things have happened between 2016 and 2022. At the same time, the OECD has data, not for 163 countries, but for 54 countries, but still 75% of value added in agriculture globally. And that data goes to 2021. So by using different sources and understanding the different methodologies in generating those estimates of support, we can have better insights than otherwise. And so the report attempts to do that. The second point, though, and more importantly, is that we're very much of the view that we need to go well beyond the information that's included in this report. Some aspects of agriculture policy are well understood and some are not. So, for example, I don't think there's much of an argument that a great deal of support today distorts production decisions, distorts trade flows. It's less clear to a lot of people that it distorts or damages or is harmful to both the environment and climate. And Anthony has just described some of the ways in which that is true. And I expect that is even less clear to many people, some of the social or the distributional impacts of support. Because so much support is provided on the basis of production, then the folks that benefit produce the most by definition. That small farmers receive relatively less support. And it also means that farmers in less developed economies, where there is a lower fiscal capacity to subsidize, receive less. So there's inherent distributional differences in the current support system. Final point I want to make relates to some of the gaps in our information. I mean, fundamentally, there is not yet an agreement as to what constitutes a bad subsidy and a good subsidy. Now, we're close, but we're not quite there yet. And I think it's super important that in particular, the definition or the parameters of good subsidies becomes more clear. And this is largely because if you look at current support, it does benefit large producers. It is linked to production, which means there is relatively less effort in improving productivity, driving innovation, enabling digital transformation, and making it more possible for the food and agriculture system to feed a growing population. So this is super important. There's less effort dedicated to environmental outcomes, the kinds of things that, again, Anthony has already talked about, and addressing the climate challenge. So there's lots of support provided to agriculture. I think our view would be that it's directed at the wrong things and needs to be redirected. Of course, our view doesn't matter. It's getting this information, these insights, this understanding into the hands and into the minds of policymakers and trade negotiators.
Thank you, Ken. But then, I mean, it matters when you look at the data and why you are saying they are bad subsidies or a bad kind of support. And then you come with another element in your report, which is the need for a coalition of stakeholders towards new agricultural policies, probably in direction to the good subsidies. So my question to both of you would be, what are the paths that you see as possibilities for such a coalition to happen, and how could they impact agricultural policies for a good subsidy, so to speak?
Okay, maybe I'll start, Anthony, and then you can come in. So there is a lot of information available, as we've just discussed, but there's also a lot of noise. So different folks emphasize different things. And if you're a policymaker, who and what do you believe? What what's your takeaway from this deluge of information and insights and advice that you receive? So our proposition is we need to bring together not just the best available information, but those multiple and diverse stakeholders that have a view. And to the extent that these views are evidence-based and fact-based, all of these views are legitimate. And it is the challenge is not to have the best factoid or the best data point. The challenge is to bring together all of the information, identify the trade-offs, the complementarities, and come together with a more coherent set of messages. So we want to bring together international organizations, we want to bring together academics, CSOs, private sector stakeholders, folks that care about agriculture and trade, but also folks that care about environment and development and science and digitalization. And, you know, rather than leave it to governments to sort through the noise, to sort through the noise ourselves and provide governments with a more coherent set of messages and a more clear pathway forward. I mean, we're very much of the view that there's a shared interest, a widely shared interest in better outcomes, you know, enabling livelihoods for farmers and others across the supply chain, addressing environment and climate, addressing food security. We just don't think that can happen with current policies, including policies that are international in nature.
If I could just add two more points to what Ken has just said. It's clear that there's a greater need for cross-fertilization of policy ideas between the agriculture sector and the rest of the economy. What we're seeing increasingly is that there are a number of broader environmental policy instruments that are not targeted at the agriculture sector, but will still have an impact on the environmental and economic performance of the sector. For example, things like carbon pricing and emission trading schemes, things like biofuel mandates, and things like forestry and native vegetation policies. We're already seeing a lot of discussion around how to bring the agricultural sector into the emission trading schemes in a number of countries, including New Zealand and the EU, to name two. The second point is, building on what Ken just outlined, is that amongst the noise, there's a lot of very useful modelling and data that can be brought to bear in the policy discussion. And at the moment, our survey found that there's a lot of useful information out there. It's mostly at the local and national level in terms of trying to quantify what the impacts are. But there's a lot more work to be done to take this into the broader policy sphere, the international sphere, looking at more global policies that take into account shifts in competitiveness and agricultural production as global issues such as climate change start to be more effectively addressed. And so I think there's a lot of work to be done there to try and make the outcome or the results of these empirical analyses more relevant and more easily accessible to policymakers and to the broader stakeholders.
Well, thank you, Anthony and Ken, and all of the topics are connected. So as you both said, we have now the carbon market, food security, and other topics that should be part of the policies and the rules as a whole to bring it all to the table. And nowadays, let's just focus a little bit on food security. And we're facing a crisis in food security due to several factors. And what intrigues me is that countries that subsidize their production and therefore are major exporters like India are restricting exports. And this is even more harmful to international trade and sustainable development in its social, economic, and environmental dimension. And what is your opinion on that? What is the environmental impact of export restrictions in countries with domestic support? If possible, I think it's interesting to hear you both.
Okay, maybe I'll start again, Anthony. You should start on the next one, and I'll.
Okay.
I need to be held back for this question. This is a really relevant issue, and it becomes more relevant when there are shocks and price increases in the world, and we're certainly seeing that today for lots of reasons. Look, let me be super clear. The immediate impact of export restrictions is to accomplish what countries are trying to accomplish at home, which is increased supplies and lower prices, and the exact opposite impact on global markets. So an import or an export restriction will increase global world prices, and it will decrease global supplies. Okay, so the immediate international impact of an export restriction is to push prices up and to reduce supplies available to feed people. So that's what happens immediately. The long-term impact is also extremely worrisome because it reduces confidence in trade and in international markets as a reliable source of supply. So if you are a net food importing country reliant on global markets, you have to be extremely worried about export restrictions and more hesitant than otherwise to rely on markets to feed yourself, to feed your population. So there's a significant negative immediate impact globally and a significant long-term impact globally as well. So what should we do? We should avoid using export restrictions. And if we do use them, we should remove them as quickly as we possibly can. To help in all of this, I think this is generally understood. I mean, as are some of the reasons that countries do revert to export restrictions. But, you know, some years ago, G20 countries established something called an Agriculture Market Information System, AMIS, whose purpose was to help governments avoid making things worse, including by introducing export restrictions unnecessarily when markets were tight. So AMIS is a group of G20 plus a handful of other major agriculture producing and exporting countries, whose purpose is to share information, to be sure everybody understands market realities, the situation with stocks. You know, if things are tight on the Northern Hemisphere, but they're looking better in the Southern Hemisphere, just to get a base of information available to all participants so that they can make better and better informed decisions with respect to how they respond to any particular, you know, market disruption. And one of the clear things that AMIS tries to do is to help governments avoid making things worse, whether it's export restrictions, panic buying, hoarding stocks, and so on. So there's a collective, widely held interest in not making markets perform worse than they would otherwise with poor policy decisions.
And just picking up on the environmental side, it's clear that if you add further distortions into the relative prices and incentives facing farmers in the form of export measures, this will just compound the problems for the environment that might be created, that are created by domestic support that is provided in the first place. So the combination is environmentally diabolical. In the country that is imposing the export restrictions, this will encourage farmers to increase their production in ways that may or may not be environmentally sustainable. For countries outside the rest of the world, as Ken said, export restrictions tend to push prices up. The farmers will respond in ways that may be increasing production in that particular commodity. And then this will, depending on the environmental policies in place, likely have adverse environmental impacts in these other countries. So it is both economically and environmentally quite a damaging combination of policy measures.
Thank you both. I think my final question, taking all this scenario into consideration, which is so serious, is to understand how multilateral stakeholders such as the WTO and the OECD, which you both mentioned before already, on their roles into this situation. I mean, how could they collaborate and how they could support in direction to policies for good subsidies, for lowering the environmental impact of this kind of support? How could they interact? I would like to hear on that. Thank you.
I might kick this one off, Ken, and I might just talk a bit about the OECD, and perhaps, Ken, you can talk about the WTO, which is more in your neck of the woods. In relation to the OECD, the issue of climate and the environment is now very much mainstreamed within the OECD. It's very much a multi-sectoral, multidisciplinary issue. And almost every part of the OECD is doing some kind of work on the environment and climate as part of their normal work program. Work on agriculture, work on trade, cities, innovation, economics, macroeconomics, tax, education. It's now truly one of the core issues within the OECD. It's no longer an exclusively environmental issue. Now, this is a really great step forward. It enhances collaboration. It enhances the ability to bring a range of policy and analytical tools to bear on the climate and environmental issue. But it is also a real challenge in that it is imperative now to make sure that all of these bits fit together to tell a coherent narrative and to drive for a strong and mutually supportive and connected set of policy outcomes and recommendations. I think the signs are all good that this is working well inside the OECD. It's in the right direction. And then you expand that to the broader group of international organizations who have an interest in this. You know, the World Bank, the IMF, the Asian Development Bank. You know, there's a range of international organizations where that same kind of multidisciplinary, multi-sectoral analysis and policy work can be really supportive of these kind of outcomes.
Yeah, just to build on that, you know, look, the OECD, as Anthony has described, is all over this issue from the point of view of economic and policy analysis and advice. The WTO is a multilateral rulemaking organization. So there is a wonderful complementarity in their respective roles and responsibilities. So the WTO, its members, hopefully, are avid consumers of the kind of information that the OECD produces. We think that both organizations and their secretariats can work even more closely together. The WTO is a very member-driven organization, as is the OECD. At the WTO, though, it's driven by members so much that sometimes the secretariat is perhaps excessively constrained in what it's able to do. And this is not in the report, I don't think it is, but it's certainly a firmly held view of mine, and I don't think I'm alone, that it would be a good idea to unleash the capacity of the WTO secretariats and let them contribute more to some very, vexing problems and so far elusive solutions. But bottom line, the WTO and the OECD can work much more closely together within their respective responsibilities to do two things, to generate even better data and information and analysis and advice for governments. Governments will decide, not international bureaucrats, that's as it should be. But getting that information to decision makers is important, as is a second step that we don't always take at least we don't perform it very well, perhaps. And that's not just to communicate, but to socialize that information with members of the OECD and of the WTO and of the UN system. So getting information not just into their hands, but into their minds and have it interpreted and understood correctly. And just final point, and Anthony touched on this as well, this isn't just about the WTO and the OECD though. There's a number of other organizations, Anthony's named some, the FAO, the World Bank, the IMF, UNEP, UNDP, IFPRI, and on and on. All of these organizations from particular perspectives have important contributions to make. Maybe though we can do a better job of weaving it into a story that's more coherent and more penetrable for governments. And of course, there's folks outside of the international community. You know, I mentioned academics, but there's a number of CSOs with very specialized perspectives, but an important capacity and an important contribution to make to this more coherent narrative that we hope would better inform and be more not just penetrable but more usable by government decision makers.
Yes, and I believe we all need to be aware of the topics. I mean, we as consumers, we have to know this information so we can choose better what we are consuming. Yeah. So Ken and Anthony, thank you so much for joining us. Please feel free to come back whenever you want. And congrats for the study. It's a really good report. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to talk to you.
This was WITCAST, the podcast of the Women Inside Trade Network. I hope you enjoyed our talk and keep following us at www.womeninsidetrade.com.